Good morning, Central Iowa, and welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for this hour, here with Mike Murphy, who is engineering. Thank you for joining us to listen in. Showers are happening and likely to continue mostly earlier in the day, and then again, there's about a 20% chance of rain tonight. It should clear up tonight, though, and tomorrow is expected to be a sunny day with temperatures in the lower 70s. Rain should start again with possible thunderstorms on Tuesday night and continue on through Wednesday night. It should stay in the 70s, but then we should see temperatures begin to drop down into the 60s, even though the sun will be shining for the rest of the week. Saturday will be cool at 63, and Friday and Saturday nights are expected to get down into the high 30s. Not quite there, but our first approach towards the freezing mark of 32. And that's our weather. We have lots to do this hour, so I'm going to hurry on and ask Dennis Hart to give us the news. Dennis?
Former President Trump returns to Iowa. It's back to the drawing board for state redistricting, and the coronavirus continues its run through the state. All made big news last week. First, the return of Donald Trump. He came back to Iowa this past Saturday night for the first time since he lost the presidential election to Joe Biden last year. Trump held a rally at the Iowa State Fairgrounds in Des Moines. During his more than 90-minute speech, Trump launched a multi-front attack on President Biden and congressional Democrats, who he said were taking the nation to what he called the brink of ruin. He said, in his words, "We're going to take America back." He criticized Biden for his handling of the coronavirus pandemic, the Afghanistan withdrawal, and for numerous pieces of domestic legislation. Trump also repeated his false claims that last year's presidential election was rigged and continued casting doubt on the results. He endorsed Iowa's Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, who is running for re-election next year, and he also endorsed the state's first-in-the-nation caucuses. Trump did not announce a re-election bid for himself. He did say, in his words, "We must send the radical left a message they will never forget." Before Trump's visit, the Des Moines Register published a new Iowa poll that showed that his approval rating in the state is higher than he ever saw while he was president. 53% of Iowans have a favorable view of the former president, while 45% have an unfavorable view. 2% do not know what they think. 73% of evangelicals in Iowa view him favorably, as do 68% of rural residents. And 61% of men view him favorably, but 52% of women view him unfavorably. And 68% of Iowans who are not vaccinated against the coronavirus view him favorably in Iowa. Meanwhile, last week, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds joined 8 other Republican governors at the U.S.-Mexico border to criticize President Biden's immigration policies. Democrats responded by accusing Reynolds of playing politics. At the border, Reynolds said, in her words, "Over the past 8 months, we've seen illegal immigration just soar, and in fact, it's becoming a migration." And she went on, "Joe Biden has done absolutely nothing to confront this self-inflicted crisis." And last week, Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa introduced a bill seeking to deport immigrants who have been convicted of sex crimes and who try to enter the United States. Iowa's other Republican U.S. Senator, Chuck Grassley, is one of the co-sponsors of the bill. Now, the state's redistricting. Iowa Republican senators rejected the first set of proposed redistricting maps last Tuesday. The state Senate voted 32-18 along party lines to reject the proposed maps, which would have established new congressional and legislative districts for the next decade. Democrats had argued that those maps were fair and that they removed partisan influence from the redistricting process. Republicans hold majorities in both the Iowa House and Senate, and that gives them the power to accept or reject the maps. Since last week's vote, the Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency announced it will submit its second redistricting proposal by October 21st. That is much faster than the time it's taken to redraw maps in previous decades, and well within the 35-day window the agency has under Iowa law to provide the new set of maps. And the governor has set a special legislative session for October 28th to consider the new maps. At that session, lawmakers will only be able to vote yes or no and not make any changes. If they turn down the new maps, the Legislative Services Agency would have to come up with a third set. At that point, state lawmakers could make changes. The state Supreme Court has said lawmakers have until December 1st to finish their work. Now, the coronavirus. The number of new cases in the state went down again last week, and the number of hospitalizations also declined. This past Friday, the state health department reported 8,966 new positive cases in Iowa over the previous 7 days. The statewide positivity rate stayed at 9.5%. Hospitalizations went down to 573 last Friday from the 626 it had been on Wednesday. About 77% of those hospitalized had not been vaccinated. Earlier, the state had reported 91 more deaths from the virus. Since the pandemic started, about 500,000 Iowans have tested positive for the virus, and 6,654 deaths have been attributed to it. At least 333 residents and workers in Iowa nursing homes have been infected with the virus in the current outbreak in 31 different facilities. In the past 2 weeks, about 18 nursing home residents a day have been infected in the state, and a total of 25 have died. 34% of the workers in nursing homes in Iowa are not vaccinated. In a related story, a federal judge decided last Friday that Iowa school districts can continue requiring facial coverings in classrooms in the near future. Earlier, U.S. District Court Judge Robert Pratt had temporarily blocked a state law that banned districts from requiring masks. On Friday, he granted the preliminary injunction against that law. That injunction will block the law for the duration of a lawsuit brought by parents of students with disabilities and by a disability rights group who argued that the law violates the Americans with Disabilities Act. State of Iowa lawyers immediately filed an appeal seeking to overturn Judge Pratt's injunction. About 20 Iowa school districts have issued mask mandates since his decision. Back to the world of politics, Iowa Democratic 3rd District Congresswoman Cindy Axne responded last week to criticism that she had made derogatory comments about Iowa Christians. She said her words had been manipulated. During a virtual forum, Axne addressed the ongoing debate over masking in public schools. She said, in her words, all the anti-vaxxer crazies are out there, and called the situation, again in her words, a hot mess. She said the Christian right, in her words, hold a cross for God or whatever, and they use it like a weapon, and it's painful to watch because they've weaponized religion. Also last week, a former state representative in Iowa announced he would run for the U.S. Senate next year. Bob Krause of Burlington became the fourth Democrat to announce for the seat, now held by Republican Chuck Grassley. Krause joins former Iowa Congresswoman Abby Finkenauer, Dr. and City Council member Glenn Hurst, and former County Supervisor Dave Muehlbauer in the race for the Democratic nomination. Meanwhile, last week, Iowa's former Human Services Director asked a judge to disqualify the state attorney general's office from defending Governor Reynolds against his lawsuit. Jerry Foxhoven contends it's unethical for lawyers from the AG's office to defend the governor against the lawsuit he filed, while that same office is simultaneously defending him against a federal lawsuit that 6 former Department of Human Services employees filed against him. Foxhoven's lawsuit against the governor alleges he was illegally removed from his job. In other news last week, word that 2 people were arrested after Seidel High School in Des Moines was placed on lockdown when there were reports that a weapon had been found in a vehicle loitering in the school's parking lot. Polk County Sheriff's personnel said a person in the vehicle had showed a gun to a student. The driver of that vehicle left the school and crashed into a nearby yard. A 19-year-old female was charged with carrying weapons, and a 16-year-old boy was charged with reckless driving and leaving the scene of an accident, among other things. During the investigation, officers found 3 airsoft pistols, a .22-caliber rifle, brass knuckles, and illegal narcotics. Earlier last week, the head football coach at Seidel High had been placed on leave after players said he punished them in practice by pushing them to the brink of exhaustion. This because one of their coaches thought a player had stolen $100 from him. Head coach Austin Stubbs was put on administrative leave. There was also word last week that construction of a new 6,300-seat professional soccer stadium in Des Moines is expected to start next summer, and development of the surrounding 60 acres on the southwestern edge of downtown will be pushed along by the stadium's progress. The envisioned stadium district encompasses the now nearly demolished Dyco Superfund site and is bounded by Fleur Drive to the west, Southwest 11th Street to the east, Martin Luther King Jr. Parkway to the north, and the Raccoon River to the south. Eventually, there will be a variety of multifamily housing, retail, offices, and hotels. In another development story in Des Moines, the city council there voted to let the city proceed with property acquisitions in the Four Mile Creek area. The creek watershed's master plan is to turn the floodplain there into a natural greenway. The council's move will let the city proceed with taking land and properties in the floodplain by means of a gift, a negotiation, or by eminent domain. 27 property owners will be affected. Still in Des Moines, word that the IAC Interactive Corporation is buying the Meredith Corporation, one of the city's oldest major employers. Meredith publishes People magazine, along with Better Homes and Gardens, and others. IAC will pay nearly $3 billion for Meredith and place Meredith in its digital publishing unit. Meredith employs about 800 workers in its downtown Des Moines offices. In the world of college football, Iowa style this past weekend, the Iowa Hawkeyes kept their undefeated season going, defeating Penn State in an exciting game in Iowa City 23-20. The Hawkeyes are now 6-0 for the season. Meanwhile, the University of Northern Iowa lost to North Dakota State 34-20, and Iowa State University's football team had the weekend off. And that is your summary of quite a week of news from all around Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, happy to have been with you today, and planning to come right back here tonight live at 7 on KHOI Radio's Capital Week, when Laura Bellin and I will talk about what's been happening in state politics and what it means for all of us. Then I'll pay yet another return visit to Local Talk this coming Friday, when I'll report on what makes news in Ames. I hope you'll be here for all of it, and I hope you'll have a great week.
And thank you, Dennis Hart. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for the hour, Ursula Rudenberg. And there have been a lot of events, changes, and controversy for the Ames School Board during the past year. In this November's election, there'll be 7 candidates who have filed for 3 open seats on the school board. The open seats belong to Gina Perez, who has resigned and whose seat is temporarily being filled by Jane Ecker, Monique Benken, who is not running for re-election, and Jamette Colton, who is not running for re-election. Currently, the 7 candidates are Brett Becker, William Scott Dreyer, Rolf Duvick, Tom Pearl, Amy Erica Smith, Kira Weirstein, Kelly Winfrey. We'll be speaking to as many of these candidates on Local Talk as will be available. Today we'll be able to talk things over with 2 of the candidates, Brett Becker and William Scott Dreyer. We'll start with Mr. Dreyer. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you, Ursula. I appreciate you having me.
Thanks for joining us. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, for the last 28 years, I've been working in education. I started off as a language arts teacher and coached basketball at Spirit Lake High School, Spirit Lake, Iowa. And while there, had some really good discussions with my superintendent, who encouraged me to get into administration and leadership, educational leadership, through Drake University. And I did so and got my principal's licensure and a master's degree in ed leadership through Drake. And then went ahead and got also my superintendent license and another master's in ed leadership through Drake University. And I am wrapping up my doctorate work right now, my ed doctorate work at Drake University as well. So that's kind of my background education-wise. Principal for 20 years at the high school and middle school level. And I felt like this would be a great background to have on the school board, and I've always thought during my career that if there's ever a time where I'm not doing the duties of a high school principal, which seem to be from 7 in the morning to about 9:30 or 10 o'clock at night, I would pursue running for a school board.
What high school were you principal of?
I was principal at East Buchanan High School first, and I was there for 3 years. That was my first principal job. And then I went to St. Ansgar, Iowa, and then came back down closer to home. I grew up in Indianola, Iowa, so my last decade or so I was at South Hamilton High School in Jewell, Iowa, just north of Ames.
Okay.
Which is closer to home for me.
Right. So why now? What would you say is the main reason why you feel you want to be a candidate now or want to serve on the school board?
Sure. There's a lot of different reasons. The first being, I took a job last year with the Iowa Department of Education. So that is very much an 8-to-5 job with no evening activities. So my schedule does allow for more time to serve my community. I've always been in the position of servant leadership and want to continue to do that. And then also, I think my background in education, and when I found out there were 3 seats open and available, that became something I became interested in, talked it over with my family, And we felt like that would be a good place for me to serve because that's where my background is in education.
Now, Scott, you live in Ames, right?
I do, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I just wanted to check that because we've heard so many other locations, you know, that different places where you've lived and served. I mean, you've kind of listed, I think, what qualifies you to run on the board. What types of change would you think that you would bring to the board?
I think maybe that perspective of what it's like to tackle an issue, whatever that issue might be, from the perspective of somebody who's worked inside the walls of the school. I think that would be a unique perspective on the board at current. And not that it would be the end-all, be-all perspective at all, but it would give a little light on different things that the district's working on. As an example, if you're working on curriculum, okay, how is that going to affect our elementary teachers who teach sometimes four subjects a day versus a high school teacher that teaches one subject a day, depending upon how many classes they have?
So are there things you believe the board should have done differently in recent times?
That's a question I've had actually a lot, and it's really hard to answer only because, yeah, you can answer at face value of what a given topic, say mask mandates are. I supported the mask mandates. I think that was a good decision because I think anything we can do to keep our kids safe is a good thing. But was I sitting at the board table at that time? Did I have all the information that the board had? I didn't. So it's really hard to comment on any one decision was a 100% bad decision. Any one decision was a 100% good decision because I simply don't have all the information from the board table. I can tell you in generalities, like the mask mandate, I support that. I support keeping our kids safe. I support science. I support our doctors.
So you were comfortable with the way the board handled the mask mandate in this past, during the pandemic?
Yeah, and that was one that's a little easier to comment on only because I attended those board meetings. I was a little surprised there weren't more people attending, but I was able to hear the conversation, the initial conversation where they put it on a future agenda for a future board meeting, and then the discussion and all of the facts that were shared from the CDC. I learned a lot that board meeting. I learned about all of the medical agencies that actually supported masking, like the American Nurses Association. I hope I say them correctly. But like the American Nurses Association supported it, the American Doctors Association supported it, and so on and so forth. And I just felt like those that are employed by the district for medical reasons did a great job of sharing information and making it pretty easy to make that decision in the best interest of our students.
In speaking with you, the impression I get is really your focus is on expertise and gathering of information and really, you know, taking time to review the facts in specific situations. Am I hearing you correctly?
I think so, Ursula. I'm a data guy. That's how my career has worked over time is there's an issue in the high school, and so we gather data and make the best possible decision we can make. I think education, probably not unique to education, but one of the things about education is oftentimes there's not one 100% correct answer. Oftentimes there's shades of gray. And we have to figure out, okay, let's take all the data we have and with all the information we have and all the feedback we have and all the collaboration with stakeholders, what's the best response we can have or what's the best answer we can have to this problem that we're tackling right now? And I think that's the best way to handle things and to move forward. And, of course, you can't drag that on forever. A decision has to be made at some point and you have to move forward. But making that decision with data and with information, I think, is very important.
Mm-hmm. I guess in a way that reflects your background as somebody who's really worked in education and, you know, been trained to approach it in a systematic way. I wanted to ask.
I would say that.
We've had reports of increased violence in the schools. Recently, a teacher was punched. What are your thoughts on how to address this and rising concerns about mental health with young people?
Yeah, two questions there. First of all, I'll go ahead and address the first one with violence in school. To me, that's a culture climate issue. When I was a high school principal, these types of issues, I can remember one district I came to and the board was very clear. We need to clean up our culture and our climate, and you will be on a short leash to make sure that happens. And fortunately, we were able to get that done with our teachers and with our students and with our parents, a lot of collaboration. But if you have a good culture and a good climate in your building, it doesn't mean you're not going to have outbursts. It doesn't mean you're not going to have disagreements. It doesn't mean there's not going to be situations that require, say, consequences or something like that. However, I don't believe they get to the level of where we've seen them in Ames here in very recent history. And again, am I inside those walls working with those folks on a daily basis? I'm not. Do I know everything about every single incident that happened? I don't. But I do know that in school districts where I've seen a good positive culture and a good positive climate, these types of incidents are at a minimum or don't happen in terms of the violence. And I would say that reaching out to students and getting students involved in this process of finding out what it is that they want in their high school, I think that's very important right now for Ames, is finding out what is it that they believe in, what is it that they want on a daily basis. Because I guarantee you, if you sit the student body down and have a conversation, you're not going to have a group saying, well, we want to have fist fights every single day and we want violence. No, they don't. They want to get along. They want to come into a safe environment. They want to learn. They want to be able to discuss things freely. They want to be able to share their concerns. Mental health, the second part of that question. I do believe in mental health first aider training for staff. In my previous district, we had first aider training for staff, and it was very beneficial.
What is that?
It's some basic training, just in a nutshell here, some basic training that gives your staff the ability to identify some students or maybe even some staff members who could potentially be struggling with some mental health issues. It does not make those staff members mental health professionals by any stretch of the imagination, but it just gives them some insight and some resources to explore a little further when they see a student that looks like, wow, they're always answering questions in my class, but the last week their head's down, their shoulders are drawn in, they're not their same self. They can take that then and say, does this meet some of these checklists, which
so
might imply that
so
they're
kind
having
of,
a...
It's kind of like looking for warning signs, right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it's important because, let's face it, for 8 hours, if you're in no activities at all for 8 hours, these kids are with us in the school building, right? We need our staff members to be able to identify some things and pass that on to people that can help and can assist. And I think that's very important right now. You see school districts, I know at my previous school district, we were working with an outside agency, getting them some office space in our building where they could actually work out of our school building and see kids. And they were also going to branch out and see parents as well on an appointment basis. So I do think that that's a growing area. It's certainly an area of need in our schools. The days of a child coming to school and having a need that's, let's just say, non-academic, and us saying, well, we're a school, we don't deal with that, we just deal with the academic side of things, those days are gone. Kids are spending a majority of their time in our schools, and we need to respond to the different needs that they have. And I would put staff in that category as well.
How do you think that the board handled the Black Lives Matter last year?
Well, I've been able to talk door to door to quite a few people, and maybe I've asked that question more than it's been asked of me as I've gone door to door just to try and learn. And what I've heard in going door to door is a myriad of things. Some people felt like it was just done very hastily and fast, and they wish that maybe the teachers were given some more training on the curriculum and how to use it effectively. But yet I talked to another mom who tells me, wow, my child came home and was all excited, and the teacher did a great job with the curriculum. So I think there's a vast array of answers to that. And because there's a vast array of answers, that tells me that maybe everybody needs to be a little more on the same page with what the curriculum was and how to use it. Like anything else, you can give teachers some incredible tools. But if they don't know how to use those tools effectively, or they haven't been given time to get ready to use those tools effectively, sometimes you don't get as much as you can out of that. Now, having said that, again, have heard from multiple parents and some high school students as well that have said it was great curriculum. We really enjoyed it. It gave us a unique perspective on some things, and we had some great discussions in my classes. I don't know how that can be a bad thing.
Yeah. Do you think that the district should teach concepts such as racial justice or equity?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. I do. And I think we need to have a very robust, well-rounded discussion about that. And in education, students are willing to sit down and have an amicable discussion. Government classes, social studies classes, whatever class you want, they're willing to sit down and have an amicable discussion without argument and without yelling and screaming and without politics often. Adults aren't quite as good at that. But our children are very good at that. And to give them, you know, information and say, how do we feel about this? Let's have a discussion. And you know what? It's okay that Johnny over in the corner doesn't agree with that, but Susie wholeheartedly agrees with it. And they both can explain why, and they both can understand that point of view without saying, well, no, I'm not even going to try to understand that point of view. That makes no sense. We are a diverse population in Ames, and Ames becomes stronger every time somebody learns a little bit more about somebody else. Every time that happens, we become a little bit stronger as a community, and our schools become a little bit stronger. And you can see it as a teacher. When kids are, wow, I've got a class with a student that's nothing like me, and I learned a ton from them today in class when we started talking about this concept, and I had no idea that perspective. So, I welcome those things.
Okay, well, thank you. Before we end, there is a group called Ames Deserves Better. Are you a member of the group, or do you support them?
I am not a member of that group, no.
And what do you think of their assertion that the district is losing ground in academic achievement?
Here's the thing you have to look at with academic achievement this year. Last year was kind of one of those years where you say, wow, we just had this pandemic, and this was as unique a situation in academics where we had to hit the brakes and then all of a sudden shift gears and be going 100 miles an hour in about 2 seconds. So there's a lot of things to consider when you're looking at academic progress over this last year. And I choose not to throw the baby out with the bathwater on that. I don't want to say, oh, it's because we did Black Lives Matter curriculum, or it's because of this, that, or the other thing. There's a lot of things that were involved with last year. A lot of kids being schooled in ways they've never been educated or never had to learn. And you have to take those things into consideration in terms of some of the things we're used to seeing in Ames. We have about 12 national merit finalists. I would say that's probably one of the top schools, if not the top schools in the entire state. Now you're talking about some kids that are up there towards the top end. And I know we have some concerns about some of our kids in the middle and some of the academic issues there, and those need to be addressed. We also look at our ACT scores. Last year, I think it was, we averaged 25.2 on the ACT. Again, it has to be towards the top in the entire state of Iowa. It's above the state average for sure. I think it's easy to throw some of those things out there. I guess what I would ask somebody that was saying that, can you tell me specifically what data you're talking about? I would like to talk about that and see what affects that data.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm speaking with William Scott Dreyer, candidate for the Ames School Board. Thank you for your thoughtful answers. to our questions, and I'm going to have to hustle on. We have a lot to cover today, but thank you so much for being here, and you're welcome to stay if you'd like to hear my conversation with the next candidate, who will be Brett Becker. Let's take a brief music break, and then we'll get right back to it. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Ursula Rudenberg. Before the music break, we spoke with William Scott Dreyer, a candidate in November's election for the Ames School Board. Brett Becker is also running for the school board. Welcome to Local Talk, Brett.
Thank you, Ursula. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak with your listeners today.
We've kind of decided to ask everybody the same questions, so I'm going to go through the same set of questions that I just asked earlier. So let's start out by you telling us a little bit about yourself, who you are, your background.
Yes, I come from a long line of educators, Ursula. My grandmother was a teacher, and she ran the business department at a high school in Pennsylvania, and that was unusual in the 1940s for a woman to do that. Both my parents are teachers. My mother was the only child in her family, and she had three brothers to graduate from college, and then she went on to become a high school teacher. My dad was a middle school English social studies teacher. My wife, Anita, until her recent retirement, was for 20 years a Title I paraprofessional, teaching elementary school kids to read. And our daughter, Leah, is currently in the last year of her PhD program at the University of Illinois, where she's pursuing a doctorate in early American literature. And once she finishes her dissertation, she also wants to teach. And in my profession, as an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church for 30 years, I've been teaching and preaching about history and diversity and faith to a group of people throughout my ministry. And now I'm excited about applying some of that experience and some of my passion for education and learning to serving on the Ames School Board. And I'm excited about that prospect.
So what about your experience as a pastor do you feel qualifies you to be on the school board? How does that translate?
I think it translates well. For all those years, I have kind of been in a dual role. You know, you hear about in the art world somebody being a double threat, somebody can sing and dance. Well, in my role as a pastor, I have both been kind of like the principal role or a superintendent role, where I am sharing vision and energy and message. But at the same time, I've also worked with a board for all those years. And I've learned how to cooperate and communicate, collaborate, and even compromise at times to come to decisions that are big decisions that affect a large group of people. So I'm confident in my ability to do those things if I are elected to the board and to work with my fellow board members, whoever those are, to come to conclusions that will benefit the students and teachers, staff, administration in the Ames Community School District.
So your focus is really on communication, right? Your ability to communicate with people?
I think that's the beginning of all good decisions, when we're able to understand someone else. And so that starts with listening. Are we listening to our fellow board members? Are we listening to the teachers, the students, and those who are affected by the policies the board makes? That's where it all starts. But I think a big part of that is collaboration, that we need not only to listen, but to work together and to find ways to make decisions that reflect everybody's best wisdom.
And what kind of change do you think you would bring to the board?
I think what I would be able to do is to enhance what the board already, I think, does well. I am a chess player by avocation, so I spend a lot of time at the chessboard analyzing situations. You know, Ursula, there's a common phrase in our culture that is, don't just sit there, do something. But in chess, and I think as in a role on the school board, it's just the opposite. Don't just do something, but sit there. Sit there and analyze the information we've got, the data, pay attention, then make a good move. And as Scott was saying earlier, I think the moves are never perfect, but if they can be good ones, then they can move us forward. But we have to look at all that information before we do. It's tempting to just want to do something because people are clamoring for an answer at times. But I think it's more important that we take the time even if some people get impatient with us, to make the best move.
Are there things that you feel the board should have done differently in the past year?
I wouldn't say differently, and I didn't have all the information. I wasn't sitting at the table. I do have some questions about the resignation of our former superintendent, Jenny Risner. I think that I don't know why all that happened, and I think people in the community wonder that too. That's what I've heard from people as I've gone door to door and knocking on people's doors. Why did that happen? What were the details? Well, a lot of it's confidential information. We don't know when we're not sitting on the board. I trust the board that they made the decision that was the best for the community, but a lot of questions about that. And I don't know the answer to that, except that if I were to be given a seat on the board, I would try my best in as much latitude as we would have to be transparent in the decisions we make and in the deliberations that we take.
So are you saying, kind of indirectly, that you feel that the community should have been better informed about why she left?
No, I'm not saying that, because I don't know if they could have been better informed.
Mm-hmm.
But I think perhaps all along, as we make decisions as a board, if we can do our best to be as open with information and transparent, that would be one of my goals.
Mm-hmm. How do you think the board handled the coronavirus pandemic?
I think they handled it as best as they could have. What an upheaval that was for all of us in our culture and in our society. There was so much new, so many things that were challenging, and a lot of information coming at us, and a lot of things we didn't know. So I felt that they made the decisions that were best for the safety of our students and teachers and continue to do that. I applaud the mask mandate that they put into place by unanimous vote at a recent meeting. Like Scott, I've been attending a number of the school board meetings, and I think Scott's still on this call. So Scott, I'll see you tonight at 5:30 at the school board meeting. But I think that was laudable, because they were saying, listen, until the CDC changes their guidelines, or until we have a lifting of the pandemic in some way, then we have to consider the safety of our students and teachers and staff and administrators above all else, way above our convenience or our desire to not have to put a mask over our face.
Okay, so let's talk about the violence that we discussed a little bit earlier. What are your thoughts on how to address the issue of an increase in violence in the schools?
Thank you for that question, Ursula. Well, obviously, violence is never acceptable, and there has to be rules and guidelines and then consequences for those who perpetuate that violence. Having said that, I think it's so important to take time to look into the roots of those behaviors, and even of the bullying behaviors that we see on campus. Social, emotional learning is so important today in our schools, and teachers need to be trained in how to help students develop and a way to assess and accurately understand what's going on with themselves and their emotions. And too many times that isn't the case. So we need to make sure that our social-emotional learning skills and teaching is paramount. In addition to that, I'm aware and have been made aware of an app system. And I know when I've gone door-to-door, a lot of the parents aren't aware of it, but it's called Anonymous Alerts. It's been part of our school system for about 3 years now. And parents or students can, through an encrypted app, report bullying, cyberbullying, or other personal issues that students are struggling with, and have the staff immediately respond to those. And that way it's private and it's not out in the open for everybody to see. Because I'm aware of statistics recently, Ursula, that say that the majority of bullying incidents are not reported, especially if there's been no physical harm to the student. So if they're not physically harmed and it's not obvious, they don't want to report that bullying often because they're afraid of the retaliation they might get further. And that has a chilling effect on the safety in our schools. So let's use that Anonymous Alerts application and other methods for making sure that bullying and fighting are reported so that we can deal with them.
Do you feel concern about mental health concerns? Do you see this as something in a more general way that needs to be addressed?
Absolutely. You know, things have changed in our culture. They've changed in our schools. And in some ways, if we grew up in a former era, we may not understand them. But that doesn't mean we don't have to respond to them with compassion and with understanding. I agree with Scott Dreyer, who spoke earlier, that our staff does need more training in recognizing when students are struggling. But having said that, I think it's vitally important that we hire more health professionals in the district and more counselors. We have to have those people available so all the pressure doesn't go on the current staff and teachers, in addition to everything else they're required to do to take care of our students. when we see warning signs, yes, we need to refer, but we have to have people to refer them to. So let's make sure we use our budget well to hire more who are skilled and trained in those abilities to diagnose and treat the students who are struggling.
Okay, so let's talk about the Black Lives Matter Week. Sure. How do you think it was handled, and do you think the district should teach concepts of racial justice and equity?
I've looked over that entire curriculum, and I think it was a good curriculum. I think that it was broad. I've been saying throughout my campaign, broader is better. So let's keep it broad. Let's share information. Let's talk about the history of racism in the United States. Let's talk about how individuals who've been in marginalized groups have felt and have been treated, and how there's been disparities. There are learning disparities, and we need to continue to address those. I do think that teachers need a little longer with that curriculum. I mean, as I looked over it, how do you get ready for that unless you've had some time? So I think that perhaps was an improvement that could have been made with that, with the Black Lives Week of Action at schools. You know, I am aware that today is Indigenous Peoples Day. Just a couple days ago, President Biden signed into law that this would become a national holiday. And I think that speaks to this whole area of our curriculum and what we're teaching our students. Here's an opportunity to honor the customs and the traditions, the people who are Native American peoples. Let's do that today, and let's continue to do that, because all of us, if we're broader in our understanding, then understand ourselves better too. Just because we're focusing on Indigenous peoples today doesn't mean we're not focusing on ourselves and our own needs also. We need to think about all those things together instead of pitting ourselves against one another, either racially or in gender or in our sexual orientation. We need to listen to one another. We are a diverse culture, and Ames is a diverse city, especially in terms of Iowa standards. So let's keep those things broad, and let's celebrate them.
Okay, and finally, we spoke earlier about the Ames Deserves Better group. Are you a member of this group, or are you seeking their support?
I am neither of those. I'm not a member. I'm not seeking their support.
And what do you think of their assertion that the school district is losing ground on academic achievement?
You know, we're still really high in our ratings, and I think that's important. We do have a number of students who are doing well, but we need to address the learning disparity that's been present for years between Black and brown students and the white students. Why is this happening? Let's get down to those root causes. And I believe if we do that, Ursula, if we do spend that time and that energy and make that investment, that those ratings may go back up, because all of our students then will be served and be learning together and growing. So I don't think it's as bad as they're making it sound, and I think we still have a lot of room to move forward, but we have to serve all the students. And that, to me, is vital to the health of every one of our members of our schools.
So you don't feel that the decline is really because of the claim that was made that there's a divisive curriculum?
Absolutely not. In fact, I would say it's almost the opposite. We include a curriculum that is broad and that is inclusive of all students and their concerns, so that if I'm a student of color, I see myself represented in that curriculum instead of always feeling like I'm on the outside. Then that diverse curriculum will not be divisive at all. It will be unifying to our students and staff and schools. And what a gift that would be if we can embrace that instead of being afraid of curriculum, because it exposes us to things that we're not used to. You know, I've heard one of our other candidates for the school board has said we need to stop proselytizing politics in the schools. You know, in my profession, I know all about proselytizing. When we share about accurate history of our country, and we're honest about that and how some people have been disproportionately and negatively affected, that's not proselytizing. That's education. And education is what we need to be all about, and what my whole family's been about, and what my whole ministry's been about. That kind of broadness will benefit all of us, and it doesn't have to be divisive at all.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Mr. Becker. I'm speaking with Brett Becker, and he is one of the candidates for the Ames School Board, and I really appreciate you sharing your thoughts, and really appreciate having both of you on today, Scott Dreyer and Brett Becker.
Thanks again.
And thank you for your willingness to serve the community.
Thank you, absolutely.
And this is Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. Thank you for listening. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for the hour. Keith Morgan is Story County Emergency Management Coordinator, and he has returned for his monthly check-in just to talk about keeping our safety, a safety check-in. Welcome back, Mr. Morgan. Welcome back, Keith.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, good. It's good to see you. Still miss you in the studio, but it's good to see your face anyway via internet. Keith, we're in a wonderful weather hiatus period right now in Iowa when there's a few less weather emergencies at least than usual. As we prepare for the winter, we do have some pleasant days to enjoy here. So we hate to get into it, but is there anything we absolutely should be thinking about right now when it comes to winter?
Yeah, sure. One of the things that folks need to be thinking about is now's the time to get your car in service to make sure that you've got good tires for the upcoming winter. You don't want to be out there running on tires that don't have the tread to keep you on the road. Another thing is to start prepping that winter kit for your car. Time to start digging out the coats and gloves and hats and those sorts of things, clearing out the trunk, making a space so that you can fit those things in there. Because as we've seen, we could have snow on Halloween night, and this stuff sneaks up on us pretty quickly, and you don't want to be caught out there not prepared because winter came a little bit faster than what you anticipated.
Okay, so preparation is everything, right?
It definitely is. And to get back into that mindset that pretty much any time you're going to head out, especially when it starts getting cold, is that you've got a fully charged cell phone, because that's a great tool to keep yourself safe nowadays. It allows you to reach out and get help when you need it that we didn't have before. So making sure your cell phone is fully charged, you've got that kit in the back, you've got that collapsible shovel, so if you just happen to get a little bit stuck in the snow that you can shovel out a little bit and get yourself back on your way will be some of the more important things to do. But also start looking at your house, make sure that you change the filters. If you haven't had your furnace serviced or checked out in a long time, that's probably a good idea, because improperly operating furnace can create carbon monoxide, which is deadly. And also get a carbon monoxide alarm for your house so that if something does go wrong, that alarm will go off and give you a chance to get out of the house.
Keith, what should be in the kit for the car?
Main things are just the warm clothing. Have extra coat, maybe blankets. Gloves is probably one of the most important things, because you're going to have to get out if you are stuck in your car. You're going to need to get out, clear that tailpipe so that you can run the car, keep yourself warm. And again, going back to carbon monoxide, that's the way to make sure that you don't get overcome by those fumes. Again, a candle can be, it's amazing how much a candle can bring up the warmth inside of a car should you be stuck. And also, if there's any sorts of something that you can put on your car, or those reflective triangles can help out, you should have those in your car at any time. A first aid kit also is another important thing to have in your car. And like I said, that little shovel and maybe a little bit of sand to help you get yourself out if it's just you've slightly gotten yourself stuck in the snow.
Where does one get those reflective triangles?
Usually, of course, online mm-hmm. is one of the places that you can get it. Places like your farm fleet stores tend to have those a little bit more. Hmm. Some of your big box stores will tend to have those sorts of safety items.
Okay. Yeah, I have to admit, I've never had one of those. I guess I'm going to add that to my kit. Okay, well, thank you, Keith. You had mentioned that you might be able to share with us a little bit about how your work has changed over the years. I'm kind of curious what you can tell us about that.
Well, a lot of what has changed is a recognition for the need of people with specialization like what we have. Well, when things first started off, the world wasn't as complex as it is, and usually the event didn't impact as many people, didn't involve sharing resources from the federal, state, and local levels. So nowadays, when I started off, I'm a product of the older way, which is you went through one complete career, like me, I was in the military, and then you switched on over. And a lot of times there were problems with folks still being very, as we call it, tactically oriented and not having a a good understanding of government on the larger scale. Now we've actually got 2, 4, and even graduate degrees, doctorate degrees in emergency management. But with that, it's a little bit difficult because our career field is very flat. There's usually only one or two people, so there's not a process to be able to grow through years of experience. So we have a professional organization that's doing things like mentoring the new folks that are coming in so that we can develop them. We're working with DMAC and Iowa State to try and integrate some lessons about emergency management so that somebody that's going to be a mayor or a city manager understands what emergency management is and what it isn't so that we can grow our profession. We don't all wear the same uniform, so it's a little bit harder to exactly know what an emergency manager is, but we are starting to get folks to recognize what the service we provide and why it's important.
It's interesting. So what you're saying is that people come to your job from a lot of different backgrounds, that there's really no one path to becoming somebody who manages emergencies for a county, right?
Correct. We've got some folks that came from the business side. Mm-hmm. We've got folks that were fire, law enforcement, or emergency medical services. We also have dispatchers that come in. Like I say, military folks like myself. So it is those life experiences are being brought across. But what wasn't there for the first 10 years or so was that educational component. And now they're starting to recognize the need to provide that baseline for folks so that they can then hit the ground running a little bit better when they move into these kind of positions.
So in a way, you're saying that the field is maturing a little bit, the field of emergency management.
Oh, yes. It's definitely maturing. It'll take quite a bit longer to really get established. The other thing is my job here at the local level is quite a bit different than somebody at the state level because they can specialize in just recovery or just the mitigation, whereas we have to have the broad cross-section. So mm-hmm. We are still struggling to say, who is an emergency manager? Is somebody that does business recovery for a company, a large company, an emergency manager versus somebody that does it on the governmental side? So lots of different things that we're coming together and trying to grow.
Do most counties in Iowa have somebody like you, somebody who is the official emergency management coordinator?
I was looking at the legislation. It was back in the 90s or so where they really started to specify that each county has to have an emergency management commission. Now, those commissions may share an emergency manager. We've got one emergency manager that covers 4 different counties. We have some emergency managers that share their halftime emergency management, maybe doing environmental health and others within those counties. The size of the county and the resources of the county and the requirements of emergency management in those counties really dictates to what level they have emergency management.
Earlier in the show today, I asked various candidates what qualified them to be a member of the school board. So you are our emergency manager here in Story County. So what about your military training qualified you for working in this position?
I was part of the special operations community where we had to work with the Army, the Air Force, the Navy. We all needed to come together quickly. So learning to work with different cultures and everything was one part of it. I also did an awful lot of operational kind of activities, long-term planning, but also crisis response. I was part of a headquarters that had to be out the door in 6 hours with a plan for some crisis that popped up. So that sort of both the long-term operational program management, but yet that crisis response training was probably one of the things that I felt suited me well to this job.
Yeah, and also your experience with collaboration with different parts of the military that you mentioned earlier, I can attest to that's really your calling card is your interest and in ability to connect with everybody, including KHOI. So we really appreciate the work you do with us, too. I kind of took this opportunity of the mild weather right now to learn a little bit about you, but next month we'll be back to talking about how to take care of ourselves as winter approaches more. And we'll probably go through the emergency kit one more time. But as Keith always says, it's better to do it early, right? So that you have time to fix things that don't go right, right?
Exactly. And to make sure that you can purchase those things that might be out of stock when it comes time first part of November because everybody else has beat you to it.
Okay, so get your emergency kit ready in the trunk of your car now. Okay, well, thank you, Keith, and we'll see you next month. And this has been Local Talk on KHY Community Radio. I've been Ursula Rudenberg, your host. Keith Morgan has been the Story County Emergency Management Coordinator who has been speaking with us, and he will return next month. And Mike Murphy is at the engineer. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m. on Mondays and tune in at 7 p.m. in the evening for Capital Week. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Stay tuned for headline news and Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. and Morning Masterpieces at 9 a.m. And remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHY meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
This is KHOI 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames, and surrounding areas.